I solved a big snack problem in our household in a very simple way. My children love eating berries, and so do I, for not just the taste, but the vitamins and nutrients, fiber, all the good stuff we want on a regular basis. The problem? We all know what it's like to pick up a berry we just bought, and it's already growing fuzz in the fridge. So I've switched to buying frozen berries. And a favorite I look for now is Washington Red Raspberries. Did you know 90% of frozen red raspberries in the United States are grown in Washington State and mostly grown on family farms who harvest them during peak ripeness and clean and freeze on location, sealing in all that freshness, taste, and great nutritional value. So now I use frozen raspberries in our yogurt or smoothies as a sweet treat. And I love that this means I can support local American farmers and have a healthy snack for my family that withstands the test of time. You can find Washington Red Raspberries at your local grocery store or Costco. And how do you know you're getting the good stuff? Well, you just take a peek at the packaging and look for product of the U.S., and then you'll know you're on the right path. Oh, and if you want some fun recipes and more information, go to redraz.org. That's redraz.org. And you're going to find recipes, health tips, retail locations, everything you need to make frozen Washington red raspberries a regular part of your routine. Overall, it's just a smarter choice. Hi, everyone. Welcome to your mini scoop. And we find ourselves at the end of another week where a storm remains our big story. We really want Mini Scoop to be a place where we talk a little bit about what we found interesting this week in news, or perhaps flag a story that you don't normally see. But in this moment in time when we've seen two quick successions of storms that have been really devastating, it just seems appropriate to focus here for a moment. And I find myself inspired by a sheriff that I tripped over in my reporting on a social media post where he was talking about how challenging moments can produce some interesting revelations. And in the spirit of that, I thought to myself, how can we use this particular moment in news as an opportunity to learn, where we take a challenging time and remain curious about it, with respect and acknowledgement that so many are impacted by Hurricane Helene and Hurricane Milton. By the way, as I'm reporting this morning, we're still getting our arms around the damage and devastation from Hurricane Milton. Luckily, the storm has passed through Florida, but this is a story we're going to be following for some time. So I acknowledge that today as we start off our conversation. And I wanted to explain how I arrived at these three questions I thought we should tackle today. These are questions that come up periodically with any storm system, but there's also some questions that are more specific to the political environment that we're in that many of you have asked about. So I thought it would be important to tackle that before we got into the weekend. So the three questions I arrived at included, why do we name storms and how do we name them? How do we arrive at Milton? How do we get there? How do we measure storms? Where did that really come from? And who's in charge? Who's actually in charge of disaster relief? And what about how our money is being used? So let's get to some of these three questions. Let's start off with, why do we name storms? Naming storms actually started in the 1950s, and it was simply as a way to organize these storm systems. Sometimes there would be multiple storm systems that forecasters are watching at the same time. So the thinking was, let's name them, and that will be easier to identify them and to alert the public. What's very fascinating is that until the late 1970s, only female names were used for storms. I'm going to set that aside symbolically for the moment, but an interesting part in history. And in the early 1980s, late 1970s, we started to use both male and female names. Now there's an international organization that keeps a list, and these lists change over every 6 years. So you'll have a list of names, and you won't see that same list of names until 6 years from now. So for the list of names that we've seen this season, we're not going to see them again until 2030. And there's a chance that we may never see Milton again at all, because certain names are actually retired if a storm is particularly destructive or deadly. For example, we're never going to see another Hurricane Katrina. That name will never be used again. But we're going to cycle through these different names every few years. And that's why you may even recognize one periodically. The names that we're going to be watching for next include Nadine and Oscar. And I mention that because we know that hurricane season is going to last at least until November 30th. That's, we have this time frame. We don't have it for tornadoes. There's no such thing as tornado season. That can happen at any moment. But for hurricanes, for the Atlantic season, we're looking at June 1st through November 30th. So just a heads up, the names that we'd be looking for next for a tropical storm would be Nadine or Oscar. And that's when a storm actually receives their names, when you get to a tropical storm strength of 39 miles per hour. So you don't have to be a hurricane. It can just be a tropical storm. And that's how you receive a name for a storm. And by the way, it's given through, again, this international organization. So meteorologists from all over the world, although this tradition started in the United States, the meteorologists from all over the world are going to be consistently on the same page as to which storms they're talking about. Milton just happened to be on the list at this particular time. It was the next name to come up. And that's how we got to Hurricane Milton this week. So now that we've named our storms, how do we actually measure them? We've talked a lot about category 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. We sort of run through this periodically, but who's behind this scale? Who actually came up with this idea? And it turns out there were two gentlemen behind it, Herbert Safir and Robert Simpson. Herbert Safir was an engineer, a structural engineer, and Robert Simpson was a meteorologist. He actually led the National Hurricane Center the late 1960s to the early 1970s. And so what they were trying to solve, the problem they were trying to solve is, well, how do we explain the strength of a storm? So we can communicate with the public what could be coming. And they came up with a Safir-Simpson scale that started to be used in the 1970s. This scale originally was just focused on wind speed, but pretty quickly, there was a realization that that wasn't going to be enough. And they wanted to bring in storm surge and flooding and water, because as we've discussed, water, flooding, storm surge is the deadliest part of the storm. But in 2009, that part of the scale was actually taken away. And there was a key reason for that. So the wind strength has stayed consistently, these different wind strengths for different categories. But the reason why the storm surge readings were taken away is that sometimes they didn't match. For example, in Hurricane Katrina, where Hurricane Katrina made landfall twice, once as a category 1 and once as a category 3, the storm surge that accompanied it was actually more along the lines of a category 5. And so where someone could think, oh, it's a category 1 storm, I'm going to be just fine, it's not going to be that bad. Well, sometimes the storm surge or the flooding doesn't match exactly. That's why in my own research, periodically, I've seen this scale with definitions of storm surge and flooding, and then the more updated versions do not have it. What you should know is that still to this day, the categories are related to wind speed, and we know that's very limited information because, again, I don't mean to get repetitive, but it's worth repeating. It's the water that we're really paying attention to when it comes to the most deadly element for all of us and for our families. So the scale is still being used. It hasn't been updated that much since the 1970s. It's just that little part that's been taken out as far as measurement of storm surge. So who's actually in charge when it comes to disaster? And let me just sort of answer this more broadly speaking. There's many people that are in charge. In a state, the governor can be in charge, and you also have county officials that are in charge in your particular area. FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency's whole purpose, their whole mission is to help people before, during, and after disasters. And there's been a lot of questions this week about FEMA funding. And these questions have been related to all sorts of things, from social media posts to comments made by former President Trump. In fact, I was listening to a rally from former President Trump just yesterday in Pennsylvania, trying to locate a soundbite I could use as an example. This has been a pervasive question that's come up from critics of the current administration, but also just in general of, well, where's the money? How does disaster relief work? What do we need to know about that? And it's really important to remind ourselves is that if we're American citizens, this is actually our money being used. And FEMA is the federal distributor of those funds when it comes to disaster relief. The really important thing to pay attention to is when anybody in leadership actually declares something a disaster. So when the president's declaring something a disaster, even before a hurricane makes landfall, he's instantly freeing up federal funds and resources to flow to that area in anticipation. That's also true of a governor. That can also be true of a mayor. We saw this during the pandemic, that when different areas declare a disaster, the government start to have a different level of power. For example, they can put in traffic laws that they can't normally do on a regular basis without following a certain procedure if they just declare an emergency or a disaster. So that's just one example. But let me just talk to you a little bit about this disaster relief funding, because there's been all sorts of questions many of you have asked about, well, is it true that money from FEMA is going other places? What do we need to know about our money that FEMA is managing, and could it actually be going to places that we don't want when there's a disaster and someone actually needs it right in front of us? We can see it all over the news. So here's what I found, and this was really fascinating. The first thing you should know is that there's something called the Disaster Relief Fund, or DRF. It's the largest source of federal funding for any disaster, and this is what FEMA is managing. Over the years, it looks different depending on the money that Congress appropriates to it. And if we look at from the 1990s through 2022, a total of $347 billion has been put and used in these funds. On average, every year, about $12 billion has been spent. But it really depends on the year. On a year when we're lucky enough not to have a lot of major disasters, you could have a few billion dollars spent. And then in years where there's a lot of disasters, it could be a lot more than that. Over a period of time, on average, the Disaster Relief Fund will pay for one disaster over the period of 3 years. So it's not like the money just comes in one huge pot. It's actually distributed over a certain period of time. So that's where a lot of the disaster relief funding comes from. It's from this particular fund. It's only for disaster funding. And I've seen some different reporting on this, but some have described it as against the law for this money to be used in any sort of other way. It has to be used in this very specific way because that's what Congress approved it for. Now, it is important to know that Congress can approve money to be used in federal agencies. And depending about how specific Congress is on the instruction, the federal agencies can use it in different ways. And sometimes that can get a little tricky. And also it can cause conflict. But for this particular pot of money, it's very clear this is for disaster relief. There's been a question that's come up online and also been talked about in political circles about whether or not FEMA money from the Disaster Relief Fund is going to places like the U.S. southern border. From what I can tell from my research, the Disaster Relief Fund is only for disasters like the ones that we are currently seeing on the news. However, there is FEMA money that does go directly to supporting those who have been encountered at the U.S. borders. And let me explain that. So there's something called the Emergency Food and Shelter Program. That's been a part of FEMA since the 1980s. And it was approved, Congress is part of approving funds to this, to help different areas with hunger and homelessness. So in your city or your county, maybe there is a certain organization that's getting federal money, could come from this fund to help with homelessness in your area. Over the years, though, Congress has given some different instructions for how this money can be used. And in fact, in 2019, Congress specifically supported some of the funds from this going to be used for those encountered at the border. Now, some people use the term migrants. At Smarter News, we don't use the term migrants. I think migrants it's a generic term. I find it to be derogatory in many ways. You know, you don't say, well, that's my friend, the migrant. You know, these are people, they're men, women, children, they're coming across the border. There's different reasons, as we've talked about in the past. So we're going to talk about this group of people as those encountered at the borders. These are people that are encountered at the border that don't have a home and are likely don't have a lot of resources, could be hungry. And so these sort of funds in 2019 were allowed to be moved in that direction. 2019 was under the Trump administration. $30 million was approved for that during that time. But get this, over the last several years, the money approved for this particular use of that money ballooned up to $425 million as of last year. So it is true that there is a FEMA disaster relief fund that is only used for disaster relief. There is also a fund in FEMA that is used more specifically for troubleshooting these particular areas, perhaps in your own state, in your own county. And depending on where you are, it could be also used for those encountered at the U.S. border. I thought that was really important to learn a little something about as I was peeling back this onion of spending. I couldn't believe about how much I didn't know about how our money is being spent. And also how wishy-washy this has become because Congress is spending is passing these temporary spending bills, this patchwork of spending bills. It can create so many different problems, including a lack of detail for how the money is supposed to be spent. For example, Congress can think the money is going to be spent this way, but the federal agency, let's just give everyone the benefit of the doubt, reads it and thinks, oh, well, we can spend it this way. And it's not exactly how the lawmakers intended. I thought you would find that really interesting. I did too. And it's something I want to look into a little bit more because it seems like there could be a better way. And maybe we can find one. All right, let me just leave this with you as we kind of close out here. I mentioned a sheriff that I found particularly inspiring. This is the sheriff for Anderson County in South Carolina, a county that's really been affected by Hurricane Helene. And he posted this back on October 2nd, but I keep on thinking about it. I thought you would appreciate it too. And the sheriff goes on to sort of talk about what happened in their own community and some of the challenges that they face, including the loss of life. And he finished with this. He says, I believe prayer is a powerful thing, but we need to pull ourselves up by the bootstraps and take action as well, if you're able. God didn't promise that we wouldn't have storms in our life, but he promises to be there with us through the storm. I thought that was a very interesting reflection from Sheriff Chad McBride and a way to think about these storms very literally as we're watching them go through different communities and seeing communities, the resilience in communities and the humanity for those helping each other. And also we can think about it more metaphorically, being in a challenging time, in a challenging environment, and thinking about how we're making our way through it. We can't guarantee that storms won't come through in our own lives, but remaining curious about what is there to learn from these storms can also sometimes give us a little bit of that extra inspiration to keep going. And that's what I want for all of us. I know what it's like to go through a period of time where you're feeling a great amount of uncertainty and you can't see through the cloudiness of your own life. And you just have to keep going and ask, what am I supposed to learn from this? What can I learn from this? And it's really tough to do, especially in those really dark periods. So I just wanted to share that with you. All right. We have a lot more news to get to as we move into the following week. I'm really excited to hear what you're curious about in the news, what you'd like to hear more about, whether it's on Miniscoop or our broadcast Scoop on Mondays, where we lay out the week ahead for our Smarter News insiders. If you're interested in supporting Smarter News, this is a great way to do it. You could join our group. You get an email delivered to your inbox on Monday with a special broadcast. You could also join us live, which is a lot of fun because we're able to interact and I love talking to you and seeing you on a regular basis. So consider that, scoop.smarternews.com. In the meantime, we'll be back with quick, concise, nonpartisan news throughout the weeks leading up into the election and beyond, God willing, on smarternews.com. Have a great weekend. I'll see you soon. Bye.